This is a total guess as to where we are. Have I gotten this far yet?
No.
Okay. Did I make it to four even?
Nope.
But I did make it to three. Well, let me just quickly summarize again what three is all about. The photograph represents an ecosystem. And the point is that in any given ecosystem, there is a flow through of energy, whereas for materials, it's not a flow through, it's a recycling. So energy comes in, gets transferred and transformed, and then leaves in a different form as heat. Transformation of energy means that it's turning into a different kind of energy, like the radiant energy of sunlight gets turned into the chemical energy of the sugars that photosynthetic organisms make, and so on. That's different forms of energy. Transfer of energy refers to the fact that energy gets moved from one object to another, whether it's a living object or a non-living object within the ecosystem. But materials more or less stay put. They don't enter and leave, except for some leakage between ecosystems. They pass around. So the stuff you're made of used to be the stuff other things were made of and will tomorrow be parts of other things as well. Your body is not is always made up of different stuff, even though you look pretty much the same day to day. And in slide four, we can see the heat that's leaving. Energy comes in as sunlight, gets transformed and transferred, and then eventually leaves as heat. So that's different from the materials. It's a flow through, entering, getting changed, and then leaving as far as energy is concerned. All right, now we can go to five. And the big point about five, just as an example, it's just one of many examples, is that there is a close correspondence between structure and function, or between form and function. What that means is that organisms are built the way they are because that's what works for doing what the organism needs to do in that environment. And that's because of what? What is it that leads to this closeness between form and function? We say form fits function. Yeah.
Is it evolutionary adaptation?
It is evolutionary adaptation. And what is the mechanism of evolution that leads to adaptation? Evolution can happen three different ways. What is it?
Natural
selection, exactly. That's why, over time, things appear as though they were designed. That's not how it happens. Changes happen just accidentally because of mutation in DNA, and those random changes that don't end up giving traits that don't work as well die out. But the ones that actually work better than what was before, you know, get passed on, and therefore over generations the structures get better and better fit to their function. And the example here is with bird skeletons. Birds are not all that delicate. We like to say that a lot. But they birds that fly, which is most birds, have to withstand a lot of forces. The flapping of the wings produces a lot of forces that a skeleton has to be strong to withstand. And you could make a really strong skeleton by making it solid, but that of course is a problem for a bird, right? What's the problem there? Yeah.
Too much weight, so they won't be able to fly?
Yeah, they wouldn't be able to fly. It would take even more energy than it already takes to fly, and their muscles wouldn't be able to generate that much force. So they have pneumatized or air-filled bones to make them lighter, but they're still strong. Now, I just got done telling you that natural selection doesn't work by design. It works by just accepting accidents that work well. But we, of course, can design things. If you think about this from an engineering perspective, if you're an engineer and I tell you you need to make a cylinder of some given material, like a bone, but I give you an absolute limit as to how much material you're allowed to use, I can say you can do whatever you want, you just can't go over this amount of stuff. Then you could make a rod, a solid rod, right? But you would quickly use up all of your allowed material. And therefore the rod would have to be small diameter because it's solid. That makes sense? Well, if you are going to bend this thing, like say at this angle, when you bend a cylinder, on this side it means things are going to have to compress, and on this side things are going to have to stretch. You see that? And the smaller the diameter is, the smaller that amount of compression and stretching, which are resisting being bent, there is. And that's why a narrow cylinder is easier to bend, like a coat hanger, for instance. But if you make it a wide diameter and still try to bend it at the same angle, that's going to be a lot of compression here and a lot of stretching there. And it's going to resist it a lot more. It's going to be a lot stiffer, in other words. And this is exactly why in modern bikes you don't have solid rods, right? You have large, nowadays, hollow tubes that are much stronger than they would be even with heavier ones. So this is what, you know, the mutations that accidentally led to hollow bones were favored more and more over successive generations, and that's the essence of natural selection. Okay, now to six. We have a couple cells that we're seeing on this slide. One big one in the middle, and this is another cell. Well, there is, in terms of cells, a dichotomy in biology. Dichotomy literally means cut in two. But a dichotomy is a two-part way of looking at something. And in terms of cells, in all of the organisms that have ever existed, including the ones alive now, there are two major types of cells. And we call those prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. However many cells an organism has, which can be one or more, as we've said, unicellular and multicellular animal organisms, all of the cells that an individual has are either prokaryotic or eukaryotic, so there's not a mixture within an organism. And by the way, these are adjectives. The organisms that have a prokaryotic cell are called prokaryotes, and the organisms that have one or more eukaryotic cells are called eukaryotes. We are examples of that. We are eukaryotes. But notice that these two words share that karyo part, that root. And that root means kernel originally, like the core of something. In terms of a cell, what that's referring to is this big conspicuous purple thing in this one cell, which is the cell nucleus. Now, not every cell has a cell nucleus. And in fact, it's only fairly recently, relatively recently, in the history of life that this has come into existence. The original cells didn't have it. There were billions of years of life before it came onto the scene. So it's only hundreds of millions of years ago that the nucleus came into existence evolutionarily. And there's still plenty of cells. Most cells alive now, most organisms alive are prokaryotes. That's always been true, and it's definitely true now. So but the pro part of prokaryotic means before, and therefore the name literally means before the nucleus existed. These cells existed before the nucleus existed. And EU, as in eukaryote, means good or true. So eukaryotic means having a true nucleus. Now what makes a nucleus a true nucleus is that it is membrane bounded. The nucleus, if a cell has one, is an example of an organelle, first of all. And we already talked about organelles being one of the levels in the hierarchy of biological organization last time, right? Atoms, then molecules, then organelles. So the cell nucleus is an example of an organelle. But more specifically than that, it is a membrane-bounded organelle. And I need to alert you that there are two very similar phrases we use in biology that you shouldn't confuse, although even some textbooks do. And that those two phrases are membrane-bounded and membrane-bound. They're not the same thing. Now, bounded, as in membrane-bounded, is the past tense of bound. To bound means to form a boundary with. In other words, to have an edge. And so membrane-bounded means that thing is enclosed by a membrane. And that's what I'm talking about now for the nucleus. It is a membrane-bounded organelle. Later on, though, we'll use the phrase membrane-bound. For instance, there are membrane-bound proteins. In that instance, bound is a past tense of bind, meaning to tie or to connect. So a membrane-bound protein is not enclosed by a membrane. It is part of the membrane because it's tied to it. All right? But anyway, back to membrane-bounded organelles. The nucleus is an example of one. And that is really the only basis for the distinctions in the names, meaning that a prokaryotic cell does not have a membrane-bounded nucleus. It doesn't have a true nucleus. And a eukaryotic cell does. But despite that being the only reason for the name difference, it's also true that a prokaryotic cell doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. It doesn't just not have a nucleus, it doesn't have any membrane-bounded organelles, which are things like, besides the nucleus, the endoplasmic reticulum, a mitochondrion, a chloroplast, things we'll study later. Only eukaryotic cells have membrane-bounded organelles. Now, every cell that has ever existed has a membrane called the plasma membrane, which some books call the cell membrane, which is its boundary with the rest of the universe. That's really what defines the cell, is the plasma membrane. Everything inside that is the cell. Everything outside it is the exterior. So to be a cell, you need a plasma membrane, and that's why these cells, having this plasma membrane, are able to act like little test tubes, as I said last time, in which the chemistry of life, metabolism, can occur in relative isolation from the surroundings. Well, prokaryotic cells have a membrane like any cell. They have that cell membrane or plasma membrane, but that's the only membrane they have. And therefore, a prokaryotic cell is not compartmentalized. It has just one chamber. It's one interior. We can see this up here. All of the stuff inside a prokaryotic cell collectively is called the cytoplasm. Cyte means cell. C-Y-T-E by itself means cell. And plasm means stuff. So it's the cell stuff. On the other hand, eukaryotic cells, by virtue of having membrane-bounded organelles, are compartmentalized. They're broken up into little chambers separated from each other within the cell. And so that's because these other membranes form boundaries. So a eukaryotic cell has a nucleus, and that nucleus is a true nucleus because of the membrane that surrounds it, and that membrane is called the nuclear envelope. Well, that separates the stuff that's inside the nucleus, which is in the cell, from the other stuff that's inside the cell but outside of the nucleus, and therefore it's two compartments. And therefore, we don't use the word cytoplasm to refer to everything in a eukaryotic cell. The stuff that's in the nucleus is called nucleoplasm, stuff of the nucleus. And the stuff that's still in the cell but outside of the nucleus is called cytoplasm. This light brown stuff is the cytoplasm of a eukaryotic cell. We can also see that there's variations on this. There's ranges in size, but as a good average, a typical compact-shaped eukaryotic cell is about 10 times as big as a typical prokaryotic cell in each of the three dimensions. So it's 10 times as long, 10 times as wide, 10 times as tall. That means by volume, it's 10 cubed times as big. It's 1,000 times bigger than a prokaryotic cell. You could fit roughly 1,000 prokaryotic cells into a typical eukaryotic cell. And this is one reason why you can at least make a little sense of the fact that your 100 trillion cells that your body is made up of are vastly outnumbered by bacteria. Those are the cells that have your DNA are the ones that you own, in a sense. 100 trillion of those, roughly. But for every one of those cells, you have 10 to 100 bacteria living in and on you. Well, they are much smaller. Bacteria are prokaryotic cells. All right, let's go to 7. Now, last time I just brought up cell theory. What important thing does cell theory tell us? That's right. Cells come only from pre-existing cells. That's the only way it happens now, and that's been the case for a long time. Originally, of course, the original cells had to come from things that were not cells, and we'll talk about how that might have happened later. But cells don't just pop into existence. They come from cells that exist before they do. And usually that results because of cell division. A cell ends its life when it splits because it's no longer going to exist technically. Right? It splits into two, but now you have two cells where you had one. And so cell division results in proliferation or increase in the number of cells, which is how you became multicellular, right? You started out as a zygote, which is a single cell. Now you're 100 trillion cells. That's because the zygote splits into two, then those split into two each for four, and then eight, and so on. Cell division multiplies the number of cells. But clearly, the cells that are created when cell division occurs didn't pop into existence. They came from a pre-existing cell. That's the usual case. But speaking of the zygote, in this slide, that's actually an exception to that. Because the zygote is created not by splitting, but by fusion of two cells into one. Right? The two gametes, which is the general word for sex cells. A sperm is a gamete. An egg is a gamete. When those fuse, that creates a fertilized egg, which is better called a zygote. That was the beginning of you. And so that's comparatively unusual compared to the splitting, but notice that it still obeys what cell theory tells us. Even though it's a fusion rather than a division, the zygote still comes from pre-existing cells. And then, by the way, the zygote doesn't stick around as a single cell very long. It then splits into two, and that creates the embryo, which gets more and more cells, and then the fetus, eventually the baby. Okay, now to 8. This is a little glimpse at DNA. And I'm not going to tell you very much about DNA right now because we're going to spend the entire second half of the term on thinking about DNA in one form or another. But I just want to introduce it here because of its importance in biology. It's the most famous molecule in the world nowadays. Plenty of people who have never had a biology course can tell you what DNA is. They recognize it. Even if you just show them a picture, most people would recognize it as DNA. Well, DNA is an example of a nucleic acid. And nucleic acids are one of four categories of biological macromolecules. Now, a macromolecule simply means a big molecule. Macro means big. Of course, all molecules, from our point of view, are tiny, but they're not all equally tiny. Compared to like a water molecule or an oxygen molecule, macromolecules are very big. And all organisms that have ever existed are made up of the same four categories of macromolecules that we'll study one at a time in a different chapter. But I might as well introduce those right now. Or does anyone already know what the four are? I just told you that nucleic acids is one of them. What are the other three? Well, what is it? Yeah, go ahead. You don't have to raise your hand.
I remember it. Is it like guanine?
Those are components of nucleic acids. Those are not themselves big. So those are building blocks from which you can make a big molecule of nucleic acid. But there are three other totally different categories of big molecules or macromolecules. One of which is proteins.
Lipids
is one, and there's one more. Carbohydrates, someone usually says that, and you might have even been taught that, but it's not quite correct. And that's because carbohydrates is a huge group of molecules, very general. Carbohydrates are all consisting of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, but that doesn't say anything about how big they are, right? So there are plenty of carbohydrates that are big, but there are plenty of carbohydrates that are not big. Glucose is a perfect example of a carbohydrate that's not big. It's not a macromolecule. It's a monosaccharide, a small one-piece sugar. Well, it can be used if you have a bunch of other monosaccharides to build a macromolecule that's a big carbohydrate. But since I'm telling you that these four categories are macromolecules, we should not use the term carbohydrate, which includes both macromolecules and non-macromolecules. Instead, we should name the category for the types of carbohydrates that are only macromolecules, which is polysaccharides. So those are the four: proteins, polysaccharides, lipids, and nucleic acids. And DNA is in the nucleic acids category of those four. Why are they called nucleic acids? Well, they have acidic properties, but what about nucleic? Why are they called that? Because in a eukaryotic cell, at least, where you find DNA is in the nucleus. It's a nucleic acid. But don't let that confuse you, because DNA is required for all cells that need to live for an extended period of time. And so that includes prokaryotic cells as well. Prokaryotic cells need DNA for exactly the same reasons that eukaryotic cells do. But of course, by definition, they don't have a nucleus. They were named that even though the DNA in a prokaryotic cell is not in a nucleus. By the way, it is, if I just quickly go back to the picture showing the cells, slide 6, a prokaryotic cell's cytoplasm is all one compartment, but that includes DNA, which is not spread randomly throughout the entire cytoplasm. It is kind of concentrated in a region in that cytoplasm. It's just not enclosed by its own membrane. And so that region of the cytoplasm is called the nucleoid. Now, the oid suffix means like whatever it's connected to, right? Like humanoid is not human. It's a human-like thing. A nucleoid is not a nucleus because it doesn't have its own membrane. But that's the region in the cytoplasm where the DNA is. All living cells need DNA for the same reasons. And when I say reasons, there are two real reasons, two major functions of DNA. And one of those has to do with the lifetime of that cell, and the other one has to do with the time between cells, actually. But last time I think I told you that we often say that DNA gives individuals their traits, but that's not actually directly true, right? Did I say this?
Yeah.
What did I say do directly give individuals their traits?
Proteins,
another category of the macromolecules. Proteins do just about all the important stuff in any cells. That's why they give you directly your traits. But as I said last time, no cell is able to build any kind of protein on its own. It has to be told how to do that. It has to have an instruction manual, so to speak. And the information that makes up these instruction manuals is in the form of DNA. The process of producing a protein is a two-step thing that we'll look at the details of in a different chapter. But that two-step process, those two steps, are transcription first and then translation. DNA is involved in only the first of those, transcription. It's not involved in translation, but you can't have a protein unless you go through both of those. So as we'll see in more detail later, transcription takes the information in DNA and creates another nucleic acid, RNA, which is now holding the information. DNA's job is done at that point. And then RNA's information tells the cell directly how to assemble a protein, one amino acid subunit at a time. All right? And unless you have that code telling the cell, it's not able to build any proteins, and that's why you're stuck with the traits you have, because you can't make any of the proteins that could be built if you had instructions, but you don't have the instructions for because you don't have that DNA. All right? Anyway, that's one of the major functions of DNA, and that's the function of DNA throughout the lifetime of that cell, whether that cell is an entire organism, like a bacterium, or whether it's just one of your many cells. Individual cells, even within a multicellular organism, have a certain lifetime, right? They're only going to last so long. And they're busy doing whatever kind of things that cell does. Well, that really means making all the different proteins that are required for doing those jobs, which means continuously consulting the library of instruction manuals called the DNA. And that entirety of the DNA in an organism is called the genome. The DNA is consulted throughout the lifetime of the cell for the purposes of transcription so that it can then build proteins in order to live. The other major function of DNA, though, is not really so much about the lifetime of the cell, but for the next generation of cells that cell is going to produce when it splits. When a cell splits, it's ending its own life and creating two new cells in its place. Now, if you think about having to do that, if you're a cell, you have a genome that is the set of all the manuals needed for the proteins that you require for life, then you're set because you have a whole library of manuals, a whole set of genes. But if you're going to split into two cells, and you want those cells to be viable, meaning able to live, then each of those two new cells is going to require your entire library. Because each of those two cells is going to have to be able to make every kind of protein that the cell is able to make to remain alive. Is that clear? Well, there's only one library to begin with because there was only one cell to begin with. So if you're going to do this bit of splitting into two equally viable cells, then before you do that splitting, you need to make a perfect duplicate, a copy of the entire genome. And that is the other major function of DNA. Chemically, it has the remarkable ability to serve as a template for how to make a perfect copy of itself. And therefore, that second function of DNA is replication. That happens shortly before splitting, so for a brief period of time after the replication, the one cell actually has two genomes, twice the DNA that it needs to be one cell, but then it splits and gives each of those cells a complete library, and they can both live. But notice that's not really about so much that cell's lifetime. It's at the end of that cell's lifetime when it creates two new cells. That's all I'll say now. Plenty of DNA time later. Now let's go to 9. Talk a little bit about feedback mechanisms. You can see that there are two mechanisms of feedback, positive feedback and negative feedback. But these are not equally represented in organisms. Negative feedback is much, much more prevalent in biology than positive feedback. There are examples of both, but the vast majority of feedback mechanisms operating in organisms are negative feedback mechanisms. And that's because only negative feedback is able to maintain homeostasis. Now, we talked a little bit about homeostasis before. That's maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment. It's keeping things that can change, variables, within tolerable limits so that the cell doesn't die. And remember, homeostasis is kind of a misnomer because no cell ever stays the same, which is what it means. It's always slightly changing at least, but it's trying to keep from changing too much. And it does this, achieves this homeostasis and maintains it through negative feedback, never through positive feedback. Now, in any feedback mechanism, you really have a few things. You have a variable of some sort, which by definition is anything that can change, right? There's all kinds of variables, like pH, for instance. Temperature is a really easy one to understand from daily life. And we don't even have to think about biology. We can just use a room for an example. Thermostasis is really just one example of homeostasis. It's specifically maintaining temperature as the variable. But temperature is a variable because it's not continuous. It changes moment to moment. And you have a thermostat, which achieves thermostasis in a room, into which you put a set point. So a feedback mechanism involves a variable of some sort and it involves a set point. Now, the variable has, by definition, variable values, but at any given moment, there is a value, current value of the variable. The set point is the desired value. It's what you put into the thermostat itself, right? Well, you also have a thermostat set in your brain that the body wants the temperature to be at. But the point here is that whether it's the room or your body, the current temperature, the real temperature, is almost never exactly at the set point, right? Because the temperature is going up and down, and it's only when it perfectly crosses that set point line and when it equals it. Most of the time, it's either a little above or a little below. In other words, most of the time, there is a difference between set point and current value. And we call any difference between those two an error. So those are the three things that a feedback mechanism involves: a variable, a set point, and an error. Now notice that if there is an error, which there almost always is, it can be in either of two directions, right? The temperature currently can be either too high or too low compared to the set point. Both of those are errors. They're just in opposite directions. Well, I don't want you to confuse yourself into thinking that negative feedback is for one of those situations, like if it's too high, and positive feedback is for the other. That is not right at all. It's only negative feedback mechanism that is operating in both cases of those errors. You know, for the thermostat, if the temperature is too high, it's going to kick on an air conditioner, which is going to bring the temperature back down towards that point, which means it's going to reduce the error. But if it gets too cold, it'll kick on the heat and once again reduce the error, this time by bringing the temperature back up to set point. In both of those cases, though, what the device is trying to do is to reduce or eliminate the error, right? To eliminate it would mean that the temperature is perfectly at set point. Well, a word that means to get rid of or to eliminate is negate. And that's why negative feedback gets its name. It is the type of feedback that is able to negate or get rid of the error in either direction. Positive feedback, on the other hand, is the opposite of that. It never leads to homeostasis because it never reduces the error. It always increases the error. Wherever the current value of the variable is, positive feedback will push it even farther away from the set point. Because of that, any positive feedback mechanism, which are kind of rare compared to negative, has to be temporary. Either because it's going to kill you, which is kind of, it's temporary until you die, or it is a, it's not going to kill you, but it's a temporary mechanism that operates and then for a certain amount of time, and then negative feedback mechanisms come into play to restore homeostasis. And even though there aren't nearly as many examples of positive feedback as negative, there are plenty within biology. It's just that most textbooks use the same example. It is a good example, though, because it's real life. I mean, you can understand it from experience, maybe. Which is parturition, or childbirth. So, as I describe it, makes sense in your mind as to why this is positive feedback. What happens during labor is that the now developed fetus, which has gotten quite a bit bigger and is usually upside down in the uterus, with head pointing to the cervix, the narrow cervix of the uterus, that head starts to stretch the cervix. And the stretching gets sensed by the nervous system, sending information to the brain. The brain responds by releasing oxytocin, which is a hormone, and like all hormones, gets delivered into the bloodstream. That means the whole body receives that information, that hormone, that signal, but almost the whole body ignores it because a signal does nothing unless the tissues have receptors to receive the signal. The rest of the body doesn't know the oxytocin's there. But it reaches the uterus, and the uterus has receptors, and it responds by squeezing, especially at the fundus or the upper end where the feet are, pushing the fetus farther downward. That results in the head stretching the cervix even more, so that the error has gotten bigger now, in a sense. And that sends an even stronger signal to the brain, which responds by releasing even more oxytocin, causing even more squeezing, so it just keeps building. That's positive feedback. It's temporary because either the woman dies or the kid pops out. And if everything goes well and she does survive, or they both survive, then negative feedback mechanism will take over and restore homeostasis to keep her alive. Alrighty. 10. This is a representation of classification. Taxonomy is classification. It really means names of groups. A taxon is a real general word that means a group. By the way, the plural is taxa. So all of these headings at the top are taxa. Species is a taxon, genus is a taxon, and so on. This is another hierarchy, like the hierarchical organization of biology, from atoms up to the biosphere. This is hierarchical as well. So for instance, a phylum is a group, a taxon, that contains smaller groups, some number of classes within it, each of which contains orders and so on. It's nested or hierarchical. You probably have heard of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species, maybe. Were you taught those ever? And you probably have at least heard of genus and species. Well, we've been classifying organisms for thousands of years. And by the time... Well, originally, when we started calling these things kingdoms and so on, kingdoms were the biggest groups, and there were only two originally. They just said, everything is either a plant or an animal. Of course, we know there's many other kinds of things, fairly unrelated to plants or animals. But it was two to begin with. Then by the time it got around to my life in about fifth grade, there were five kingdoms, but kingdoms were still the biggest things. There weren't any groups bigger than kingdoms. Well, nowadays, there's many more than five kingdoms, plus kingdoms aren't even the biggest taxa anymore. As you can see here, there's an even bigger group or taxon called a domain. And those are still currently the biggest. So domains are the largest, most inclusive, including the most, taxa. And each domain contains a certain number of kingdoms, and so on all the way down to genus and then species. And these last two, genus and species, often go together, but they're just two separate taxa, like any of the others, like phylum and class. They go together often, though, because of how we give scientific names to organisms, like Ursus americanus in this example for the bear. That's an example of, the scientific name is what we call a binomial, which simply means two names. A binomial is simply a listing of an organism's genus that it belongs to, followed by the name of the species it belongs to. So, Ursus americanus is not the species. Americanus is the species. Ursus is the genus. And similarly for humans, we are Homo sapiens. We belong to a genus called Homo, which used to include several living species. It still includes the species, but we're the only ones that still live. And we're on our way out pretty soon, too, extinction-wise. But anyway, we're the only species in Homo. Most genus, genera, which is the plural of genus, have several living species. But our species is sapiens. Our genus is Homo. But whatever the binomial is, whatever organism you're describing with the scientific name, there's a proper way to do that, which is shown here. You always italicize both the genus name and the species name. You always capitalize the genus. You never capitalize the species name. Now, you italicize the whole thing, both of them, to tell you that it's a genus and a species rather than a bigger taxon. The other ones are not italicized, like family and order and so on. Domains, then, are the largest, and as we see in slide 11, there are three domains that we recognize. Now, the bottom one in this figure, C, notice, is called domain Eukarya. You might have already recognized that that domain is named for the fact that it includes eukaryotic organisms, or eukaryotes, including us. That's true. All eukaryotic organisms that have ever existed And only the eukaryotic organisms that have ever existed make up the domain called eukarya. And remember that eukaryotes is one half of the dichotomy. There's two cell types, but notice that there's three domains. So even though there's one domain dedicated to eukaryotes, called eukarya, notice that there is not a domain called prokarya. So the other half of the dichotomy of cell types, all of the prokaryotes in the world, are split into two domains, which are bacteria and archaea. Bacteria, logically enough, the domain bacteria, includes all of the bacteria. All bacteria are prokaryotic. By the way, prokaryotic organisms are single-celled. Eukaryotic organisms are either single-celled or multi-celled. But bacteria are just one type of prokaryote, is the point here. The other types of prokaryotic cells belong in their own domain called archaea, which are also, as prokaryotes, single-celled. And if you were to compare these two side-by-side in a light microscope, a bacterium and an archaean, you would be hard-pressed to tell me a difference just by looking at them. Outwardly, they're very similar. But molecularly speaking, they are quite a bit different. They have important differences that qualify us in putting them in their own domain. They have their own evolutionary origins. And in fact, even though these two, bacteria and archaea, are prokaryotic, the members of archaea are actually evolutionarily closer to us eukaryotes than either one of us is to bacteria. But those are the three domains, huge taxa. Now to 12. The pink and the blue cartoon here are cilia, the plural of cilium, which means hair, but it's not truly a hair, because only mammals make true hair. But these things look like microscopic hairs on the surface of cells, which is why they were named that. Some cells are ciliated, some are not. But here we have examples from fairly distantly related organisms. The blue one is a cilium from a cell lining the interior of the human trachea, the airway to the lungs. The pink one is from a ciliated cell that is a unicellular organism called a paramecium, which is a fellow eukaryote, but that's not very it's not very closely related to us, right? Now, all organisms came from the original cell, so if you go back far enough, any two organisms are related. But these two are not very recently related. Despite that, the molecular architecture making up these cilia in these distantly related organisms is pretty identical. Not absolutely identical, but pretty close. And that kind of thing, the fact that they're shared, is one bit of evidence among many that tells us that all living organisms descended from the original lineage of successful cells. We all have a common ancestor. And so some things, you know, I keep talking about things, just mutation giving rise to new traits just kind of randomly, and those ones that happen to work get favored and they catch on by natural selection. Well, sometimes things just happen accidentally and it works so well that no further changes are actually ever adopted because it hasn't come up with a better solution yet. And cilia is an example of that. Once they came into existence, it worked so well that they really have gone unchanged for the entire time since our ancestors, the ancestor that humans and paramecia have in common, which is a long time ago, when we divided, it's been pretty much unchanged since then. So some adaptations are very successful and permanent, or semi-permanent. All right, so let's go to 13. This is more about evolution. Most of your evolution studies will be in 182, but we still have a little bit in this figure. Slide 13 is just one of countless examples of how natural selection works. We have two species here, two populations, a prey species and a predator species. The prey are the bugs, and the predator is the bird, or the birds. And notice that there is a dark background that represents a dark-colored environment in which on which these insects live. Also notice that just like in any naturally occurring population, there is variation of traits from individual to individual. A population isn't a group of absolutely identical organisms, right? Each individual has traits that can vary from the other individuals. And that's true for any given trait. We don't care about any of the other traits here in this example, though, except for one, which is the trait of coloration. Some of these individuals are dark-colored, some of them are lighter. Well, the bird just wants to eat. It doesn't have a preference for a light-colored or a dark-colored insect. It wants to eat, and it wants to not spend too much time and energy doing so. It wants to just get it over with, right? The more energy it spends looking for things, the less likely it's going to survive, because it might not make it through the day if it wastes its energy trying to look for a specific insect. So it jumps at the first one it sees, whether it's dark or light. But since the background is dark, it's going to much more easily see the light-colored bugs because of the contrast. So that means in the population of bugs, the light ones are at a disadvantage because of the genetic hand that they got dealt, right? They're going to get eaten, and when an insect gets eaten, it dies. It's not able to pass on its DNA version, which gives lightness to the body. So it's not going to pass on the trait of lightness if it doesn't reproduce. The dark ones, yes, some will be eaten, but a lot of them will be able to elude depredation or being eaten because they will not stand out against the background like the light ones do. That means they'll survive, a bunch of them will survive and pass on the darkness trait to the next generation. And so the next generation will be made up of individuals that have a higher percentage of darkness than lightness, right? That's evolution by definition. It's a change in the population makeup. And that will become more and more drastic as long as the environment doesn't change. This is why, over successive generations, populations become more and more adapted to their surroundings. Now, in a real-world example of this in Europe was a famous textbook example. Still, it probably is, but there's, like I said, there's countless examples of this. But anyway, it's kind of the opposite situation, the reality one. Because the background was light, there were insects living on the bark of trees, but the bark was really light-colored. And so it was the opposite situation, right? It was advantageous to be light if you're a bug. That allowed you to not get eaten. The dark ones stood out. And so the population was mostly light for that reason, because of natural selection up to that point. But then the Industrial Revolution came around, and we started burning so much coal that everything got sooty, including the bark of the trees. The bark turned almost black. And therefore, the previously advantageous light ones are now at a disadvantage. They stand out drastically, and the dark ones are favored. So if the environment changes, then the selection pressures change, and therefore other things are selected for and against. And within a few generations, almost all the bugs were black at that point rather than light. All right. 14 is a tree-like structure, as you can see. We call these structures phylogenetic trees. Phylogeny is also classification. Well, as I've said, we've been classifying organisms for millennia, but throughout most of that history, we haven't really paid attention to whether things were related to each other or not. We just put them into boxes or put them into groups pretty much based on how they look to us. So a worm and you put in with a snake, even though they're no longer, I mean, they're not really related to each other. Or a bird and a bat, because they both fly. Well, modern classification does not do that. Modern classification is phylogeny, which is classification based on shared ancestry. It's how things create offspring and pass their DNA downward. And phylogenetic trees represent that passing down from a lineage of DNA. This tree right here is not a complete tree. It doesn't stand by itself, I should say. This actually is just for these finches. But this tree is really just a tiny, tiny edge of what you could draw as the enormous one tree of life, which would have a common ancestor, the trunk of the tree that I keep saying is that original lineage of successful cells that we all came from. So it would have a hell of a lot more lines on it, the tree of life, and it would include all three domains and all of the descendants throughout time. This has to do with the scientific method. You have probably been taught this at one point in grade school or something, that the steps of the scientific method or something like that. It really is important to go through this because I have found that probably about half of students confuse two of these things. About half of students confuse hypotheses and predictions. So let's go through this. It really all just starts with observations. Humans, whether they're trying to be scientists or not, just in the course of being human, notice things about the world. That's simply observation. And since we are curious animals, we wonder why. So observations just lead naturally to questions about why things are the way they are observed to be. And then questions naturally lead to answers or explanations for those, right? And that's what a hypothesis is. It's an explanation saying why things are that way. And linguistically, a hypothesis is a declarative statement. You declare such and such is this way because such and such. And you pretend that it's true. You say it in a way as though it's true, even though you don't yet know whether it's true at all. You say, this is the reason that things are this way. So because is a big word in a hypothesis. It can tell you that you're looking at a hypothesis and not a prediction. All right? But the hypothesis is, it follows from the question. It answers the question. Might be wrong, but it's a possible answer. Well, hypotheses then logically imply predictions. But predictions you can tell from the language as well. They will have words like will or if, right? A prediction says what will happen if that corresponding hypothesis actually is true. So let's look at the simple example here. The observation is that the flashlight doesn't work. She wonders why. There are two possible hypotheses listed here, but there can be any number of others. It's not to say that there are only two hypotheses possible. One, though, is that the flashlight doesn't work because the battery's dead. The other is the flashlight doesn't work because the bulb is burned out. Both of those are said as though they're true, but you don't know that yet, right? But the dead battery hypothesis logically leads to the prediction that if it is true that the batteries are dead, then changing the batteries with fresh ones will make the light work again. Will is another important word in a prediction. Okay, so don't confuse hypotheses and predictions. But once you have a prediction following logically from a hypothesis, the prediction logically implies a way to test whether that will actually come true, a test of the prediction. And a test of a prediction is otherwise known as an experiment. This is truly where the science comes in. This is where science gets distinguished from other ways of looking at things because of the testing, or at least experimental science, I should say. So you actually go ahead with some sort, you design an experiment to test a prediction and see whether it comes true. So to test hypothesis one, she changed out the batteries. It's still not working. So the failure of a prediction to come true in an experiment is proof that the hypothesis is flawed. It might be flat out wrong. It might just need to be adjusted, in which case you'll have to not only change the hypothesis, but change the prediction, and therefore change the test. So, importantly, the failure of a hypothesis to come true, meaning the disconfirmation of the hypothesis, that's not a failure. That happens in science all the time, and it is valuable information because it tells us definitely this hypothesis is wrong. Knowing that is valuable. So don't think of it as a failure of the scientist. Well, in hypothesis two, the test was to change the bulb out, and notice that it lit this time. So if a prediction does come true, what does that tell us? Right, it tells us that the hypothesis might be true, not that it is true, and we never can say that it's true, actually, when you get down to it. We don't truly know anything, like gravity, for instance. But if a prediction comes true, it tells you that it might be true. The easy way to recognize that this might not be true is that it could. The problem all along could have been just a discontinuity in the wiring, right? Just a loose wire. And in the course of taking it apart and putting a bulb in, she replaced a good bulb. She replaced a good bulb with another good bulb. But in doing that, she jiggled it in such a way that now the wire is back in contact. And so it works again, fooling you into thinking that the hypothesis must be true. Well, that's why you don't trust one result in science. You do things over and over. Not only as a single scientist, but scientists throughout the ages all over the world keep testing things. And the things that keep being tested over and over and always do come true, we eventually call those things facts. Like gravity and like evolution, for instance. But that can actually change as well. Because every now and then we test things a different way or whatever and find out that we were wrong before. And so we adjust facts based on evidence. This brings up the fundamental difference between science and faith, which are two belief systems. Drastically different, though. Science is belief based on evidence. There has to be evidence, or you're not allowed to call it science. You can believe whatever you want, but to believe scientifically means that there's evidence for what you're believing. Faith, on the other hand, is belief regardless of evidence. It's belief in the absence of evidence sometimes, simply because you want to believe it. And sometimes it's belief in something despite evidence to the contrary. You just ignore evidence that says you're wrong, you're just choosing to believe it. That's faith. Science not only has to be evidence-based, But if the evidence tells you that you've been wrong all along, then as a scientist, you have to change what you're calling the truth. And that's what we do with facts. Even on well-established things, like an example of this is Newtonian mechanics, how things move around in the universe, which is actually still being taught, even though we now know it's not actually true. It just works well enough. It's close enough to the truth in the macroscopic world. And it's easier to teach to people just starting out, so we continue to do it. But we learned a while back that actually when you get down to it, especially at the macroscopic level, Newtonian mechanics is not true. And so we have replaced the truth. And that it will always be true. We'll always keep changing what we call facts because of evidence, the requirement of science. I think that's it for that one. Yes, it is. Don't have much time, but I'll get a slide.